This podcast is brought to you by Deepbridge Capital LLP. Deepbridge is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Please note that investments discussed are both illiquid and high risk and won't be suitable for all investors and should be considered as part of a diversified portfolio. The content of this podcast should not be construed as financial or taxation advice. We recommend investors seek appropriate professional financial advice. Any views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. Welcome to this Deepbridge Discovery podcast. My name's Andrew Aldridge. I'm partner and head of marketing at Deepbridge Capital. The aim of these podcasts is to give you an insight into how Deepbridge works, the companies we invest in, and to bring those investments to life. In this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Brian Moretta, who is head of tax advantage investments at Hartman & Co., and also the author of a recent white paper looking at the amount of venture capital investors should be having in their portfolio. Hi, Brian. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Great to meet you. So first and foremost, could you outline your background and just a little bit about what Hartman & Co. do?
So my background, I started life as a trainee actuary in an insurance company. I joined Scottish Provident Institution, but at the age of 23, an institution was not for me. So strangely enough, I went back to university. I did a PhD.
Excellent.
Decided academic life wasn't really for me either. So, and then...
Is this going to be a running theme?
It could be a recurring theme. And then I fell into fund management. And I spent 10 years as a fund manager, most of which I enjoyed the job. The company kind of fell apart a little bit at the end. And I spent some time doing pottering almost, you might want to call it. So I did a little bit of consulting work for private equity. I did some voluntary work building jungle lodges in Malaysia.
Very nice.
Helping the scouts build World Jamboree, that sort of stuff.
Cool.
And then I kind of fell into the sort of paid for research market. So initially I worked for one of Hartman's competitors.
We won't mention any names, it's fine. That's good.
Yeah. And that didn't really work out. They was kind of changing their strategy, and someone I knew had kind of take over management at Hartman, and he basically said to me, now I'm a competitor. And I said, no, you're not, because I'm not really working for them. And he went, join us then.
Excellent.
And that's kind of how I came into Hartman.
Excellent. And what do Hartman & Co. do?
So Hartman's basic history or core sort of product is paid for equity research. So that's writing research on quoted equities. So for typically companies that are not well covered.
Okay.
So our raison d'etre is kind of small companies, usually interesting stories, so not well understood by the market. So some simple widget maker, perhaps less interesting.
Sure.
Where someone who's slightly more offbeat. So for example, I've got a quoted fund manager and they invest in closed end trusts and inflated discounts or whatever. Okay. And I had a litigation finance company. I've got a life insurance consolidator. So all things are a bit different.
Yep.
So that's kind of the core business of Hartman. But about 6 or 7 years ago, we kind of got approached by a couple of people to work in what we call tax enhanced, tax efficient, tax advantage, whichever phrase you prefer.
Absolutely.
And people basically said, we don't think research is good enough. You write good research. And you know, because our background is that we're all like long experienced market professionals. Why don't you come to this market and, write better research? And that's kind of how we came into the EIS and BCT and business sort of relief space.
And that's how our paths crossed. But indeed. Excellent. Back end of last year, you wrote a very interesting paper, a white paper, looking at venture capital and how investors are potentially underweight, or first of all, I think you were looking at kind of what was the kind of the rules and the kind of assumptions around that market. Can you tell us a little bit about where that white paper came from and the context of it?
So it really arose from when we entered the market. When we entered the market, although I'd worked investment, I'd worked primarily in the quoted space.
Sure.
I'd done a little bit of private company work, but frankly, not very much. And as usual with me, I'm an avid reader, as listeners of my own podcast know. And I was like, where's the beginner's guide to EIS or whatever? And there isn't one.
Yep.
So I started reading a lot. about venture capital generally. And I started making a few notes, and I thought, well, if no one's read the book, maybe I should.
Absolutely.
So I kind of started writing the book. And one of the questions on that book is, well, how much should you actually put into venture capital? Because it's kind of the obvious first step.
And so, there was no hard and fast rule or any kind of figures there, were there?
No, there's a kind of this rule of thumb of 10% or a maximum of 10%.
Yep.
And no one could tell me where this 10% came from. It seemed its main attraction seemed to be it's a nice round figure and it's not too big.
So it's kind of plucked out of thin air to some degree then.
I don't know.
Yeah.
For all I know, somebody did work 20 years ago and I couldn't find it because it was pre-internet and said this is the allocation.
Sure.
But I doubt it. I think it's as a rule of thumb because people are sort of get these rules of thumb and they kind of So I sort of said, well, I've got some academic chops as well. I mean, one thing I didn't say, actually, I've been teaching a little bit at Harriet Watt.
Okay.
So teaching financial maths. So amongst other things, I taught sort of Markowitz mean variance optimization. So basically, essentially the core of asset allocation.
Yeah.
So in essence, I thought, well, I've got the knowledge. I need to do a little bit of work in getting the right data and right assumptions, but I can do this. So I did this for essentially I wrote a chapter of a book on this.
Yep.
And then I sort of sewn it to one or two people in sort of presentations on the side.
Yep.
And then actually it was a conversation with you. So it's not quite a year ago. It's probably 8 or 9 months ago. We were chatting. On your first trip out after the pandemic.
My first trip over the border up north, indeed, yeah.
Yeah, and I was showing you this, and you said, this is great, we need this for the market, not just...
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Not just a DBridge thing, but absolutely an EIS and a venture capital thing as a whole, yeah.
And it was actually, I don't know why it hadn't occurred to me before, but you suggested, why don't you turn it into a white paper and we'll sponsor it? And I went, okay.
Great. Well, that's where the best ideas come from. It was in a bar, so those are where all the best ideas come. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned some of the assumptions you employed. Can you go into a little bit of detail about some of those assumptions and kind of what the background base was for the white paper then?
So if you're doing mean variance optimization, you require to make some sort of assumptions about primarily risk return and correlations of various assets.
Sure.
I decided to make it reasonably straightforward in that everyone understands equity bonds sort of portfolios. There's a variety of other assets that people use, but generally they're quite small. But the core of people's investment portfolios is kind of equities and bonds or very close related assets.
And I guess those profiles are relatively well understood by advisors in the market.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And they're very easy to make assumptions for. We all know, equity returns. You can debate the boss about whether it's 6, 7, or 8% that you expect in the near future, but no one's saying it's 10 and no one's saying it's 4.
Yep.
Bonds, it's actually very easy. You have a yield in the market. In both of them, you can look historically and get sort of the risk profile because you know what the sort of standard deviation these things are.
Yep.
Venture capital is a bit more challenging because it's unquoted. You don't have regular price data.
Yep.
Yeah, my first thought was actually, hooray, we've got VCTs, but actually they don't work because NAVs are only every 6 months. They've got buybacks, which kind of stabilize the price excessively. So even VCTs don't. There's just not really data on the volatility of
yep. Of the stocks, if you like,
and of the stocks
as a whole.
And there's certainly no data on how those price. There's no easy data.
Yep.
So I looked at academic research and somebody had done research into this and into the correlation between venture capital and other assets. And they concluded that the correlation between venture capital and equities was 0.47. Now for comparison, the correlation between equity and bonds they came out with was 0.37. So venture capital relative to equities is not as diversifying as bonds. But it's still a reasonably good diversifier. And I think that's kind of the key to understanding what the paper is about and why venture capital, or one of the reasons why venture capital is quite attractive, because it's actually a diversifying asset. And for risk, nobody's really made good assumptions of risk. So I took the reasonable leap of saying, okay, we'll just prorata the risk. So if we're saying the expected return on venture capital, there's plenty of data actually on expected returns, because you look at Nesta studies, or there's been studies in the US, and most of them get 20-something percent. Some are low 20s, some are high 20s. Some of the US post-return data is in the sort of mid-high teens, but that's also after fees. So that would reduce it. And also US venture capital in particular has a lot more bigger investments, which should be lower risk and should therefore give lower returns.
A lot of use of the word should. That's always good when writing these things, isn't it? That's where the assumptions start, isn't it?
It should. Yeah. Yeah. So for risk, I just sort of said it's kind of pro rata to return. And I decided to say, okay, venture capital is not homogeneous. We'll split it into two normal sectors. So we'll use scale up as sort of later stage, sort of series A, B onwards, and seed. And the assumption I made was that scale up, we expect return is about 15% a year, and seed's about 22% a year. And that's kind of the bottom end of the ranges from the data we're getting. So that suggests to me it's at least on the conservative side of things. That's really the key assumptions.
So kind of moving on from the assumptions to actually the results that you came across, you mentioned obviously the kind of the finger in the air 10% rule previously and things like that, and you've mentioned how the diversification between using venture capital alongside equities and how that relates to equities versus bonds, etc. But what were the results that came out of it and the outcomes of the report? Kind of what were you surprised by, or what kind of reinforced your assumptions previously, or was there anything that you kind of key takeaways?
So I think the first thing, given the data I'd got, it wasn't a surprise that when I added a bit of venture capital and said, what's the optimal portfolio, I could improve the risk-return profile of the portfolio by adding in venture capital.
That's a relief to all of us in the venture capital space, because that would be a shock if it wasn't, so that's good.
So yes, so given the correlation I had, you would expect the risk return profile to improve, and it did. So when you think of the standard curve, in the report I benchmark things against the sort of 60-40, 60 equity, 40 bond portfolio, which is kind of, I think of it as a standard because I'm a bit old school. I think these days probably 70-30 or 80-20 is probably more what a lot of investors are doing because of the low yields and bonds. If we are in a rising interest rate environment, that may change. But 60-40 seemed the starting point.
So and relatively conservative. And it's also conservative portfolio. It's nothing too racy to start with. So I think that's a fair assumption to make.
Yeah. So the bottom line is that for the 60-40 portfolio, if you add in venture capital at the optimum sort of proportion, then for the same risk, you added about 0.5% to the return. Or to half a spent is expected return. Expected, because obviously, I'm sometimes verbally get a little sloppy in using that, but everything's expected. So, on average, and things don't always come out on the average. But 0.5% when you're thinking that actually our expected return's 5% and you're getting up to 5.5%, that's a significant uplift. And obviously, if you do a 70-30 or 80-20 portfolio, you're getting even bigger uplifts, maybe up towards 1% a year. And over a year, maybe that does make a difference. But when you start talking decades,
over the medium really and long sort of term, it all adds up significantly.
Absolutely. In optimization, that is actually quite a significant uplift. So given all that, I wasn't hugely surprised. My gut feeling of the venture capital was probably a good thing. What really shocked me was the actual weights of venture capital you should get, because they were much higher than I expected. So I did seed and scale up separately. And basically, if you use seed in the 60 portfolio, you get an answer of just under 10%. Sort of,
and again, the important thing here is that the portfolio doesn't change in risk profile across the whole profile. Portfolio, it maintains the same risk profile as a portfolio, but you're adding in a percentage of seed or scale up.
Yeah, and I'll come back to that in a minute because there's something very important there.
So yeah, so
but if you add scale up, you get something that's actually sort of low teens. Yep. I think it's 13%. If I get these figures wrong, apologies. They're in the white paper.
After this should be reading the white paper anyway. I think it was around the 13% mark certainly when I read it last. So I don't think it's changed.
Yeah. And again, if you're looking at someone who's a 70-30 or 80-20 investor, those proportions actually rise towards mid-high teens.
Which again blows the kind of the finger in the air assumption of 10% kind of out the water to some degree.
Yeah, because like most investors are going to have most of their venture capital portfolio in scale-up. There's going to be one or two people who are almost entirely seed. Angels. But even if you've got a portfolio that kind of develops over time, you might start off entirely seed. But hopefully in 5 years' time, you've got a whole pile of sort of Series A, Series B, more sort of scale-up investments. So very few people will see proportions of what's relevant. In practice, most people will probably blend the two a little bit.
Yeah, I think. That's the whole point of having the balanced up portfolio, isn't it? That you'll have different elements within there. So,
yeah.
We were very excited about the white paper when you launched it, and obviously when we initially spoke about the concept, and it's now been out there in the market, and I know you've spoken to advisors and investors kind of following up on that. And what's kind of been the feedback on the research? Have you been surprised by the feedback, or has it kind of had the effect that you kind of hoped for?
I've not been surprised. Well, I think I've been surprised a little bit. I haven't had any pushback. Nobody has come to me and said, you're wrong. And I think there's a lot of people who are very entrenched in terms of they're avoiding venture capital for probably other reasons. And some of these are very practical in terms of I have two clients a year who need it, and it's too hard for me to get to grips with this for two clients. And I think there are some people out there who just don't understand the market. They perhaps don't want to understand the risk profile. Or don't want to. But no one's really pushed back. The pushback's been in kind of peripheral areas. So I had a couple of folks always saying, well, I just took a bit of money in, if a couple of investments fail and things go wrong. And it's like, well, actually, that's not about venture capital. That's about the diversification within your venture capital.
Which is a different conversation, a different step entirely. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's probably a second white paper in there because I think the amount of diversification people need is more than people usually think. But
on that point, I think it's one of those things where, again, it's where whether it's EIS or VCT or however you're investing in the venture capital space, shouldn't be done in isolation. It should be done over a period of time. And that way that's how you build up a portfolio and get that kind of the critical mass your white paper suggests that you need. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah. And certainly temporal diversification is something that I don't think people talk about. And it's something that I think matters. You and I and everybody in the market has had conversations about whether valuations are high and whether there's something of a bubble or whatever. And the reality is we don't know. But if you're investing, if all you do is invest in venture capital now, maybe you're in danger of hitting the bubble. But if you invest over the next 5 years, then if there is a bubble and it happens to burst, or whatever, you're going to be buying in at lower valuations. Oh,
absolutely.
Down
I think if anything, the pandemic has shown that the short-term impact that can be had on businesses of all sizes and scale, et cetera, is, so if you're only investing in one-hit wonder, if you like, then you're going to be susceptible to shocks like that to the market. Whereas if you're doing it over the longer term with that long-term view, then you should be able to diversification in that sense as well, I guess.
And something that I hear sometimes is what I call the lottery ticket mentality. It's the thought, well, I'm buying into venture capital. I'm hoping one of these is going to be 100 times. So if it's 100 times, I want this 100 times one to be making my fortune. So I need to have 2% of my investment into this one because then 100 times doubles my net worth or whatever. And therefore I'm rich, which is In a way, it's got its own logic, but it's actually not the right approach because 2% is just way too concentrated.
Absolutely. And also, I think, yeah, I'd hope most managers that you speak to would say that across our portfolio, you know, if we got a unicorn, of course, that would be lovely. But ultimately, it's those companies which are going to be turning 2, 3, 4 times, that are the companies which you want in your portfolio. That's where ultimately that's how you're going to get those, that kind of medium to long-term growth. If there is a unicorn in there, then great. But you certainly shouldn't be going into VC investing kind of with that expectation that you're going to get a unicorn.
Yeah. But there is a Absolutely. Law of large numbers in there to some extent. And I think, you know, it's that thing about skewed profiles of returns where, you know, there's the cliche about for every 10 investments a venture capitalist makes, 5 will return little or nothing. You know, 3 or 4 will do your 1 to 2, 3x. And then you'll have 1, 2, or 3 that will make the 5, 10, Absolutely. 15 times. And if you're lucky, that 15 is 25 or
exactly.
55.
And that's what we all want to have in our portfolio, that kind of makeup. But again, it shouldn't be that you're always chasing those massive large numbers. It's the bread and butter is going to be your kind of 2, 3x's. That's the kind of where a majority of portfolio should be. Mm-hmm.
I have mixed feelings on this, actually. It's there's trying to get the risk profiles right. You know, I heard a big American venture capitalist talk about how he thinks people should be risk-seeking in this area. And I haven't quite worked through the logic, but there's a little bit of me inside that sort of says, I understand your point in terms of... And I don't think it's just risk for the sake of risk. I think it's trying to understand where, you know, so if saying you're going to invest in venture capital and then saying, oh, yeah, I'm just going to look for investments only do 2 times, that's not going to work.
You've always got
out.
To have that growth mentality. You've always got to have that long-term objective. And I think, you know, from our perspective, when we invest in companies, you know, we are always looking a minimum 4x is the expectation for a company. Now, some of those will do that, and hopefully a majority will do that. You will then have those ones you suggested, which maybe do 10, 15x plus, etc. And then you will have failures. Mm-hmm. That's a natural beast of what we do. But, you know, you've got to have that expectation of significant growth. Otherwise, kind of, I take that gentleman's point that kind of what's the point if you're not, you know, aiming for significant growth, but you've got to bear in mind that not everything's going to achieve that.
And that's about, so there's that difference between venture capital as an asset class,
absolutely,
which is what the paper is focused on, and then there's how you actually build that portfolio, which the paper doesn't really
address. That's for your second white paper, isn't it? So that's for the next one. So just kind of talking about the venture capital and the tax-efficient investment space and the sector in the market, including EIS, obviously. Are there any kind of trends that you're seeing at the moment or what you're seeing in the market as a whole?
So I think the big thing that everybody's talking about is what hot year VCTs have had. That has been, I'm not sure if it's, I don't think they quite hit a billion, but I haven't seen final figures yet. But they're going to be pretty close. And that would be the better part of sort of 50% up, 40-50% up on the previous.
Do you expect that to be a long-term trend or is that a short-term thing for the last tax year? Or
I think that's an interesting question. People have... basically VCTs have raised more money than they've ever had. Now, verbally, they're saying their pipelines are really good. And we spoke about how valuations are up a little bit, which actually will make help in deploying. But whether they can deploy that in the timescales that everyone would like, I don't know. I think the venture capital market was so hot this year that everybody just sort of said, well, we might as well fill our boots because it's not, And completely understandable.
It's kind of the mentality of the managers of take the money while it's on the table. Absolutely.
From a business perspective, that is absolutely fine. Next year, it'll be interesting to see it. If people deploy it, then we'll see people coming back to the same extent. I suspect one or two will not deploy as fast as they would like, and the overall supply will be lower.
Are you seeing any kind of trend in where, yeah, we're talking about VCTs now, but where VCTs are investing? I mean, we're seeing that VC teams appear to be investing slightly earlier stage than they previously were, and they tend to be certainly kind of looking in around the EIS market and that kind of level of investment and stage of a company. Is that fair that VCTs are maybe investing earlier than they previously have done in order to get that growth?
I see two or three dynamics happening. And one of these is that, in essence, VCTs are being pushed down a little. You know, there is more money into institutional venture capital funds than there has ever been. I get Pitchbook emails every day. And even at the height of the pandemic, it felt like every day had another venture capital, another PE fund, whatever, raising money. And they talk about more in PE, but I think it's true in venture capital that there's a dry powder out there. So the Series A, Series B sort of stage at which venture capital trusts have traditionally invested have become more competitive. Now, rounds have probably become larger as well. So there's an offset in there. So there's maybe more scope for sort of party rounds. But at the end of the day, it's sourcing good deals at Series A probably is more competitive than it's ever been. Supply seems to be pretty good as well. So what I think we're seeing a little bit of is venture capital trusts investing further down, partially because competition, but partially I think it's securing future deal flow. I think there's a little bit of venture capital trusts saying, well, actually, if we throw out, I don't know, 20 investments of 250,000, that's 5 million. If I've got, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 million VCT, it's a small proportion of assets. And I know that from those 20, there's probably, if I'm any good at my job, there'll be 10 Series A's for me in time.
So in terms of VCTs, I mean, they've had a great year, etc. EIS, any trends in the EIS market that you're seeing or kind of any changes that you're witnessing at the moment?
I think it's been harder to discern that. They haven't had the same sort of of spike in demand that VCTs have had. They've had a better year. But given what we effectively lost a quarter with the pandemic the year before, I'm not terribly surprised by that. I think that both have probably got the benefit of, there were in 20, I'm going to say the year's wrong, in 2020, basically people sat on their hands. There was a big pandemic. We didn't know what was going on. People were a bit more cautious about investing their surplus capital. The comment one manager made to me, which I think is that the people who do it every year for tax planning,
absolutely,
we're still doing it. We're still doing their EIS, the VCTs, whatever. But the more discretionary sort of people were saying, actually, I'd rather have the money in the bank.
Is that partly why you've seen VCT come back with a bang this year then? Is that potentially 2 years of pent-up kind of waiting to invest?
I think you're one step ahead.
As always, Brian, as always.
As always. That's exactly the point. I think, we've seen that capital. People are saying, okay, I'm more comfortable. We're going to come out of the pandemic. It's not going to be devastating. And I'm tired of earning 0.5% or 0.25% or whatever on my bank account. So willing to deploy it to risk capital. There's all the secular trends that everybody speaks about as well in terms of hitting pension limits and whatever.
So in 2022, do you kind of potentially expect to see, with rising inflation in the UK, do you expect to see potential investors looking at the tax efficient investment market as a source of growth to kind of offset some of the inflation that will be impacting their other holdings? Or do you think that's something which will put people off investing? Or kind of what do you see kind of trend going forward?
I think inflation's a challenge for people at the moment. And a lot comes back to this argument, whether you see it as secular or transient. You know, is this the start of lengthy period of high inflation? Or is it something that's just going to be here for a year or two? If it's just here for a year or two, and the way the Bank of England and central banks generally have responded to it, that maybe suggests it's their perspective, although they've got one hand tied behind their back because they're really cautious about the way that companies have, or the way the economies have not recovered or failed to recover, or how fragile their recovery are. So they're probably very tempted about raising interest rates. If they perceive it secular and interest rates go back to, say, 5%, then that's probably quite negative for a lot of markets. A, people will be happy with 5% and 1%, so they'll probably put more money in the bank. B, the stock market is going to suffer. And whether we like it or not, when the stock market suffers, risk assets,
the market as a whole,
tend to get less money. If it's transient, and I think there's some, I think to my mind, that's kind of the base case. I saw some research that post pandemics, there's almost always a period of transient inflation. Economies are disrupted quite often by labor
as
shortages.
We've seen this time.
So the a priori case is on historic that is transient. So if it's transient, central banks manage to keep interest rates low. All things being equal, you know, if we get 6% inflation for a couple of years, everything's 12% bigger, revenues 12% bigger, costs are 12% bigger, profits are 12% bigger, and everything sort of gets through. Now, there's sort of two extremes there. The chances are it's probably somewhere in between those two extremes.
The truth is usually somewhere in the middle. That's what I always find to happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, forecasts are what you pay for them, paid for them.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brian. On our podcast, we always like to get a little bit of information, a little bit of kind of understanding of the people behind the podcast as well. So, obviously, you've given us great insight into the market, into the tax-efficient world, etc., what advisors and investors should be doing. But when you're not doing all that and writing white papers and what have you, what are your personal interests away from the desk?
So I have probably a unique combination of qualifications in that I am probably the only qualified actuary who is also an associate of the Association of Professional Dance Teachers.
I was going to say that's an interesting Venn diagram.
Very interesting. There may be other people in the intersection, but I've never met them. So I dance salsa and tango. I'm a bit inhibited at the moment because of I've had COVID and it's affected me more than I would like. But I've been heavily involved in these things. I've run a tango festival for a decade. I've been running salsa and tango, or helped run salsa and tango classes for university societies. I once estimated that's probably had, I don't know, 5,000 or 6,000 people through my salsa classes over the years. So
excellent. That's a little bit different from what most of our guests on the podcast that talk to us about. So that's great.
I do a lot of reading too, but that's everyone.
Not quite as much as you. I know what an avid reader you are. So, the last question that we ask all of our guests on the podcast is about the Deepridge dinner party. So, if you were to invite three people to join you for dinner, can be dead or alive, but we're excluding friends and families. We don't want to upset anybody. But who would you be inviting and why?
So, I've been thinking a lot and starting to write a bit about ESG recently. Not just because it's Flavor of the Month, but because it's something I've kind of had a passing interest in for a long time. So the three people I would like to invite are kind of three contrasting people. And the third name just got out of my head. This is what COVID does to you. So the first one I'd like to invite is Muhammad Yunus. So in case people don't know, Muhammad Yunus is the founder of Grameen. And he is essentially the guy who invented microfinance. And he started in Bangladesh. He's a Nobel Prize winner. And he's written extensively on how investing for social benefit. And he's got a very strong view about how companies for social benefit should be non-profit. So the second person I'd like to invite is John Doerr. So if people don't know him, he's a US venture capitalist, very successful. He invested in climate tech big 15 years ago, mixed success, but he's kind of at the forefront of current venture capital investing for the environment, whatever. He's recently written a book about it. And the third person I'd like to invite is a woman called Jacqueline I think it's Novgorat. I'm going to have to check this. She started an organization yep. called Acumen. And again, she's sort of that social entrepreneur. She wrote a really good book called The Blue Sweater, which I came across. And the story, I hope it's true, that she donated a jumper to charity. And then she was doing some voluntary work in Africa a little later. And someone walked down wearing Fantastic. That sweater. It was a blue sweater. So that's the blue sweater story. And she has founded this this company called Acumen, or yep. organization called Acumen. And they are not for profit, but they are stimulating a lot of social entrepreneurship, however. And she's kind of almost like one yep. of my heroines of this area. So I think those three would create
a fascinating conversation dinner. Between them as well. Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely, because they're all slightly different viewpoints. And I would just sit and listen.
You'd hope that Jacqueline would turn up wearing a blue jumper, I guess. That's the key thing. But yeah.
I guess.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Brian. That's been great. That's really interesting to talk to you as always and go through kind of your findings and your kind of oversight on the market and what's going on. So thank you very much for that. Really appreciate your time. If anybody hasn't already read the paper, then I do highly suggest that people read the Hardman & Co. White Paper, which you can find on the Hardman & Co. website or on the Deep Ridge Capital website. So, Brian, thank you again for your time.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on today.
Thank you for joining us. If you have any queries or any topics you'd like covering in any future podcasts, then please email us at discovery@deepridgecapital.com. This podcast was brought to you by Deepridge Capital LLP. Deepridge is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Please note that investments discussed are both illiquid and high risk and won't be suitable for all investors and should be considered as part of a diversified portfolio. The content of this podcast should not be construed as financial or taxation advice. We recommend investors seek appropriate professional financial advice. Any views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon.